This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota. And it's nearly the end of the shortest month of the year, which means it's time for a journalist's roundtable. And, of course, it's also nicely timed because the legislature is in crossover until next Wednesday. They have sent lots of bills to either the House or the Senate, and they're going to hammer them out in the second half of the session. We're joined, as always, by Dave Thompson. He is the Prairie Public News Director, and he joins us from our studio in Bismarck. Hello, Dave.
Hello, Doug.
Happy Friday to
you. Thank you. Same to you.
And Amy Dalrymple-Moulter is the editor of the Bismarck Tribune. She joins us today. Amy?
Hi, nice to be here.
Great to have you. And Jacob Noderman joins us again. He's a reporter with KFYR-TV in Bismarck. Jacob, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's start with the issue of the year and just get an update on that. All things COVID, you know, we're seeing, Dave, the infections going in the right direction and the vaccines going in the right direction.
And also hospitalizations are down, which is, it's all very good. We've got that rolling average, which is now looks like it's under 2%, so it's going in the right direction. I think the next step sure sounds like the rollout of the vaccines and how that's going to, you know, affect everything going forward. And it's interesting listening to Dr. Nguyen from UND talk to the Board of Higher Education. He said, all the numbers are pointing to the right direction, but he said we have to move cautiously. We don't want to, you know, get ahead of ourselves in opening things up and breaking down social distancing and not wearing masks. He wants that to stay, at least in the university system, probably until maybe summer semester.
Yeah, we don't want to get too exuberant, but it certainly feels good to be where we are for a change.
It does.
And you mentioned the vaccines. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are out there already, and today there may be a decision about the one-shot Johnson & Johnson vaccine, which would mean three. And in my lifetime, I don't think I've ever heard of medical advancements that fast and more important.
I know. I exactly know what you mean. I have not been familiar with anything that was rolled out like that. I think even when they talked about the polio vaccines, that took a while to roll out too.
Well, I was a kid back then, and I remember everybody was very concerned about getting that vaccine. And yet polio, as serious an issue as it was, particularly for families with kids, is nowhere near as dangerous as COVID-19 is now. So we've learned a few lessons.
Yes, we have.
Our vaccine capabilities will only improve as the need increases. Let's talk about this no mask mandate bill that was discussed in the legislature. Amy, is that something that the Bismarck Tribune has been following?
Yeah, absolutely. We've been following that pretty closely. It's been interesting to see that the legislature wants to limit what state governments and other political subdivisions can do as far as enforcing a mask mandate. I'm curious what it means for schools. Maybe Dave knows more about that, but I think it's going to get a lot more discussion as it moves to the second half.
Jacob, any KFYR perspective on this?
Yeah, we've been covering this one pretty tightly as well. And I think the fascinating thing about this particular bill is that when we look at the slew of executive order bills that have gone through, all the COVID bills, all the mask mandate bills, most of them that have been kind of more on the extreme side, granted, have all failed spectacularly when they hit the House floor. We're talking 50 to 60 margin votes. And this anti-mask mandate bill is really the only one that's managed to get out of the House. And even then, it's passed with a rather slim margin. So while the House certainly has its opinions on things, when it comes to the rubber actually hitting the road, they tend to take more of a cautious route with their votes. And it's going to be kind of interesting to see how the Senate treats this one, because the Senate's been really the only chamber that's been promoting people allowing mask mandates to happen. They still have theirs in place on the Senate side. So whether or not this thing gets out of the Senate is going to be what I'll be keeping my eye on.
Dave, this is just a reminder that for the past year, masks, which have been sort of the frontline defense against a virus that kills people, have been so political? And I guess it's come down to the legislative sessions as well.
Yes, and you hear some of the conspiracy theorists say that masks don't work and they've got some proof that you can go to a website and take a look. There are others who say social distancing works, masks don't, or, you know, we're all going to get COVID anyway and probably we should build up herd immunity. There is one thing, though, that really kind of bothered me about that whole thing about the debate on this. And when you listen to some of the debate on this, one of the people who brought up the mask, you know, this no mask mandate, was making some very spectacular and probably very unprovable claims on the House floor, including he claimed that Dr. Fauci is the highest paid person in the federal government.
Huh?
And I'm thinking, you know, in earlier days, this probably wouldn't have been the way discourse has been done. Now I'm going to get off on my rant being a guy who's covered 21 legislative sessions. It used to be that there used to be some model of some decorum in that, and sometimes some of these things get stepped through, but then people would gavel them out and say, wait a second, unless it's provable fact, you're not supposed to say these things. But the rules have really been relaxed.
Yeah, and a year ago from now, 500,000 people in the United States were not dead from mm-hmm. COVID-19. And that is just such a sobering number, more people than died in World War II and Vietnam altogether. And mm-hmm. I mean, American soldiers who were killed. That's just incredible that this is still a partisan thing, like seatbelts used to be, of course. Mm-hmm. You know, all kinds of things.
Seatbelts still are, yeah, in some respects. Yes.
Okay. Well, let's move on from COVID-19 to the Legacy Fund, because that's actually sort of a shining bit of hope in the North Dakota budget, because there's more than $8 billion in that fund now from oil extraction revenues. And they're talking about how to use it. Amy, what's the math they're trying to apply here?
Well, I think the most interesting thing about it is the discussion to apply a portion of it into in-state investment, and the feeling that we're really, in the past haven't supported our own interests here in North Dakota, and that shift is really interesting, I think, and I'm curious to see how it does on the Senate side.
Dave, the Senate has kind of rolled out a couple of numbers about how to tap that, you know, the earnings from that $8 billion plus fund.
Right.
Lay it out for us.
Well, basically, it's going to go to certain pots of money. And I'll tell you, I have to talk about the House bill that I thought was kind of interesting. For years, since we got more oil tax revenue, we've talked about buckets and where the buckets for the oil money go. Some of it goes into legacy funds. Some of the earnings legacy fund goes into buckets. Now they're talking about some of the oil tax money that goes into, a bucket that's going to be talking about infrastructure. We talked about Prairie Dog. And now there is an idea that you move the Prairie Dog bucket and change places with the SIF fund, SIF fund, which is basically general fund version 2 when it comes to state government. So it's an interesting thing. There are a lot of moving parts to this.
Now, as I understand it, though, they're still looking at those earnings, turning most of them back into the fund, the legacy fund.
And well, not most of them, but a lot of them are going to go. About 40% would go back into the
fund. Oh, I see. 40% into the fund and 60% would then be expended somehow.
Correct.
Okay.
And they're talking about using it as a sinking an interest fund for bonding, you know, to pay off bonds. There was a proposal to use a percentage of it, not a real high percent, but 4% of the earnings for the research at the university system. Well, that has gone by the wayside right now, and the university system is trying to see if they can restore that when the Senate really takes a look at the bill.
Dave, tell us about this measure that declares that the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, expired in 1979. What does that mean?
A couple of things. When it was passed in 1972, there was only so many years it was supposed to get the required number of states to approve it. But some states have started revisiting the issue, and they're either on a path to rescind their approval, or there are other states who are approving it finally, and they're getting close to that number, which would make it an amendment. So the state of North Dakota is trying to say, look, it expired in 1979. We had 7 years from 1972 to 1979 to get that passed. I have a little history with this. I was a high school student at St. Mary's High School in Bismarck. We were four blocks from the Capitol. 75 was my senior year, so we got out early one day, so a bunch of us went up to the Capitol to listen to the debate on the House floor on the Equal Rights Amendment. It passed by two votes in the House, 51-49. Wow. Remember, there were 100 House members at the time. There were 50 districts, 50 senators. It passed 51-49, and the debate was very, shall we say, sharp, to the point. A lot of discussion back and forth. It was kind of interesting. But this is what's going on now. There's a state senator from Edinburgh, North Dakota, who basically said that she believes that the renewed interest in the Equal Rights Amendment is tied somehow to abortion rights. And that was a lot of the discussion that was on the floor.
Judy Lee of West Fargo disagrees.
Mm-hmm, she does. And she wants to see the state retain that Equal Rights Amendment approval.
Can you just imagine, you know, there'd be a movie here if North Dakota rescinded that ERA support and ultimately it's passed except for one state. Oh, well.
It's a very complicated issue in some respects.
Well, let's talk about an issue that has really taken over the Capitol and a lot of news coverage in the past week, and that's the behavior of a particular representative in the state legislature, Luke Simons. Amy, you've written about this.
Yes, this kind of came to the forefront this week after an incident at the Capitol that was witnessed by many involving Representative Luke Simons. Yelling at a couple other lawmakers after they asked him to wear a mask, which, of course, we're getting back to the same issue.
Yep.
The mask continues to be kind of a hot button issue. But that incident, because it was witnessed by so many people, I think it sort of prompted people to ask what other sorts of behavior had there been. And there was a file that came to light from legislative counsel that had documented a number of incidents dating back to 2018 of allegations of inappropriate comments or comments that he had made to staff members that made them uncomfortable.
Jacob, how is KFIRE covering this?
Kind of a similar story. We've just been trying to keep up with everything that's been going on that end, because it seems as though every hour or so you look around and either there's another document coming out about another allegation about Luke Simons, or Luke Simons is on Facebook Live trying to defend himself. And the fascinating thing about Simons' approach to handling this has been he's not necessarily denying that the incidences in these reports didn't happen. He's saying that they didn't happen exactly as they did, or just interpreting what he said is what's the thing that he's denying. So as he's going through all of this, it's difficult for party leadership to determine what it is that they can do on their end as form as a punishment, or even if they have the authority to punish him on these grounds, because it's difficult to really determine what evidence it is we're necessarily working on. The session is out for the next week, and talking to some party leaders, they said that there's likely going to be something that happens on Wednesday, either in the form of a censorship. The word expulsion has been tossed around here and there. It takes a lot to get to that threshold, but it sounds like they're going to be taking the next few days to think over all of their options and just kind of wait and see what else comes out. And if we're being honest, what else Luke Simons says on his Facebook page.
Amy, a piece in your story really caught my eye, and that is that one reason women are reluctant to come forward with formal complaints is a fear of blowback. You wrote about this, that could undermine their ability to do their jobs. We're still dealing with that. We just talked about the ERA.
Yeah, well, I was really interested in this just from the basis that there are these complaints dating back to, or concerns documented going back to 2018, but no formal complaint has ever been made. And I wanted to try to shed light on why that might be. One of the women whose name is redacted in those files, she did talk to me, and she talked about how challenging it is to come forward because they have to have good working relationships with legislators to do their jobs. And if they're perceived as maybe overreacting or being overly sensitive, it could really hamper their ability to do their job. And one of the things that you also see in these files is that when they have come forward to leadership, there has been some comments from leadership that minimize what occurred or try to excuse what occurred. And I think that would make it really difficult for a woman to come forward if she doesn't think that her concerns are going to be taken seriously by leadership.
If I can jump in for just a moment, Amy's story was just absolutely wonderful this morning. The Tribune had two stories on the front page about this.
Yes.
But to go off the point about working with legislators, that was the whole thing about the legislative, what used to be called the Legislative Research Council, because they were the ones who were researching language and bills and drafted bills, and they couldn't basically tell legislators, you know, this is not going to fly constitutionally. They have to basically follow what the legislators want them to do. And there was some concern, and the concern came through that whatever the behavior was, it was being interpreted as potentially sexist.
Yeah. Well, another piece of Amy's story again, and Dave, maybe you've got some background or you can expand on this. The Legislative Council is the legislature's nonpartisan research arm. Mm-hmm. Director John Bjornson has kept notes of his discussions with staff and legislative leaders about inappropriate behavior by legislators. Why isn't the leadership keeping track of this?
That's an interesting question, and that one we might need to explore in the next week or two about that. But again, they're coming up to Legislative Council, and then Bjornson hears from his staff, and he's keeping notes, and he's keeping track of it. And, you know, he wants to make sure that everything is above board, that his staff feel safe, and that the relationship with the legislature is the legislators themselves is also very much above board. I understand what he has to go through and what he's trying to make sure happens, that everything stays, you know, arm's length relationship and it stays nonpartisan. I understand why he's keeping notes, and good on him for doing that.
Well, another interesting wrinkle of this, and it is a very wrinkled fabric of a story here, is that Luke Simons is supposedly a member of this ultra-conservative caucus, the Bastiat. They claim to have maybe a few dozen members, but nobody has seen a list anywhere. Because the legislature is a supermajority, Dave, does this mean that Luke Simons might be under particular peril because they just want to make an example of somebody?
That's an interesting question. I hadn't even considered that till you asked the question, but it's possible. But again, this is the war you see with supermajorities in a party. And every party's gone through it. The Democrats went through it in the late 80s and early 90s, and you saw that, especially when it manifested itself. And Doug, you'll remember this. When Nick Spaeth defeated Bill Hygard for the governor's nomination, yeah, and Ed Schaefer won.
Yeah.
And that the party really, there's still some feelings within some of the party older timers saying this should not have happened, and there's still some division because of that. Well, as you get a supermajority, sometimes you see these fissures, these cracks in it, and it could be some growing pains right now.
Dave Thompson is Prairie Public's news director, and also today for our Journalist Roundtable, we have Amy Dalrymple-Moulter with the Bismarck Tribune and Jacob Noderman with KFYR-TV in Bismarck. Let's move on to another big story that is actually south of our border but did involve North Dakota investigators. And this is the headline that was on CNN, because it's been nationwide now. The South Dakota Attorney General is under pressure to resign as new evidence reveals investigators found the victim's broken glasses inside his car. Jacob, North Dakota investigators have actually been handling this inquiry.
Yeah, North Dakota seems to find itself teaming up with South Dakota on a lot of stuff like this. I recall South Dakota helping out in the investigation regarding the Department of Commerce audit that came about, I want to say a summer or two ago, that got recently ruled on. This Ravensburg story just keeps unraveling, and it seems as though you're trying to figure out what it is the South Dakota Attorney General is trying to hold on to at this point. He's putting up a lot of these fights, and it seems as though anytime he tries to get back on his feet, just another piece of information comes out or another file comes to public that just goes against everything that he's been saying. And you almost have to ask yourself what it is that he's trying to win at this point.
Yeah. Well, this happened back on September 12th. Ravensburg was driving from a meeting, and it was at night. And in the dark, he hit 55-year-old Joseph Bover, killed the man. But apparently, according to Ravensburg, didn't know he had done that, thought he might have hit an animal. But then you've got this North Dakota investigator, Jacob, saying they're Joe's glasses, so that means his face came through your windshield. And then in the story from CNN, the investigator tells Ravensburg, who lets out an obvious gasp and says, "I wondered about that."
Yeah, it just seems as though any piece of evidence that comes out, it's just another Ravensburg tries to defend himself, and then someone, and this time it's from North Dakota, looks at one piece of information and says, "No, that's not necessarily the case. What is it that you're going for here?"
Yeah. Well, Ravensburg has been charged with three misdemeanor counts in connection with that accident that led to the death. And he's not got a lot of friends at the Capitol anymore. And again, South Dakota is pretty Republican, but the Republican governor, Kristi Noem, wants him to leave office.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting, too, because remember at the beginning, she defended him. But now there must be more within these reports that we don't know yet for her to come out and say that he should resign.
And, of course, she's got some bigger political aspirations, so she needs to have a pretty clean house, I take it.
Yep.
Okay. That was Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson, and Amy Dalrymple-Moulter, the editor of the Bismarck Tribune, is with us for our Journalist Roundtable today as well, along with Jacob Noderman, a reporter with KFYR-TV. And there's lots more to talk about. We'll get to it, but first, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. After spending the last half of the week doing damage control over comments by Dickinson Representative Luke Simons, leaders of the North Dakota GOP are now calling for Simons' resignation. House Majority Leader Carrington Representative Chet Pollard says the issues with Representative Simons began when he used expletives toward another lawmaker who asked him to put on a mask while in the Capitol lunchroom.
Because after that, then things just, there was open records requests, and then more stuff came out, so when we hit crossover, which was Wednesday, it had started then, and Thursday and Friday, haven't had a lot of free time, if you want to know the truth.
As far as whether or not Pollard expects to see Simons resign?
Because if not, when we come in after crossover, we will see if he accepts the resignation. Nothing goes further. If not, I'm sure there will be resolutions of a severe censure at the least, and expulsion is in the statement. You know, that's a very good possibility, yes.
Simons was elected to the State House in 2016. He was reelected to the seat last fall. Minnesota lawmakers are trying to decide whether the federal Paycheck Protection Plan money is a business has received should be taxable. But in North Dakota, PPP money is not subject to state taxes. Tax Commissioner Ryan Rauschenberger says that's because back in December, the feds decided it was not taxable.
Our starting point for North Dakota taxable income is federal taxable income. So if something is considered income or exempt at the federal level, or certain expenses allowed at the federal level, we automatically conform to that.
Rauschenberger says Minnesota's law is much different and there needs to be a carve-out for that federal program. And the owners and operators of darts, pool tables, and other games at hundreds of Minnesota bars are joining a legal challenge to COVID-19 restrictions. The Minnesota Operators of Music and Amusement is filing suit in Ramsey County. The suit asks the judge to roll back an 11 p.m. curfew and capacity restrictions at bars, bowling alleys, and other hospitality businesses. Dan Lieberman is president of American Amusements. He says they have 700 hard-hit employees.
This is not a political issue. It's a business issue. Filing a lawsuit was a last resort. Our member businesses have been closed for five of the last 12 months. with very little revenue coming in for almost half a year.
Bars and restaurants, youth sports, and mask mandate opponents have previously brought legal challenges, none of which have succeeded. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support is provided by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant of the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck. Naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's the end of another month. It's time for our Journalist Roundtable. And so we've got Dave Thompson, our news director, Amy Dalrymple-Moulter, the editor for the Bismarck Tribune, and Jacob Noderman, a reporter who covers government issues, among other things, for KFYR-TV. So let's start with the issue of the week in Texas and nationwide, even in the upper Midwest, rolling blackouts because of that deep freeze in Texas, Dave, where they lost generating capacity and distribution went down and people were in the dark and without water. It was a disaster, but apparently we get to share in the grief.
Yes, we did. And what I found fascinating was this idea of, you know, the Southwest Power Pool is somehow connected into all this. And then they were getting power from North Dakota, and we started seeing rolling blackouts in North Dakota. Those who are with the Midwest Independent System Operator, the other transmission authority that serves our state, they didn't have the rolling blackouts. But, you know, people like Capital Electric and Bismarck and Verendry Electric and Velva saw some 30 to 45-minute outs as they were trying to move electricity down toward Texas. But I think there is a hidden story here, and I think the hidden story is you saw the price of natural gas go sky high in Texas.
Yes, huge.
And it looks like there might be some residuals up in our region too.
Yeah. We seem to be poised to pay for a piece of that Texas independence from the grid.
Right. And this also, in North Dakota, the legislature started putting in some bills to try to make sure that we have grid reliability and resiliency, and there were things like that. A lot of them were focused toward, you know, keeping coal as a part of the mix, as a part of baseload power. But they were watered down a little bit. There seems to be a real affinity among people in the Bergen administration, and it has been for the last several governors, who said we need an all-of-the-above mix, which includes wind, solar, hydropower, and all the sources, natural gas and coal.
Yeah, I noted that bill that you reported about, last Friday, was introduced by Senate Majority Leader Rich Wardner. It would have required that all electricity generated in North Dakota would be either dispatchable, meaning it can be, you know, sent out quickly,
right,
or shut down quickly.
Yeah, exactly.
Or has backup. And that's been, altered a bit?
Yes, it has. That's the part that's been watered down in that. It's dispatchable means coal and some natural gas. And backup would be wind, solar, hydropower. And he's saying, no, we don't want to discourage wind, solar, and hydropower. We need to have that as part of mix too. So they did back it off from the harsh terms of dispatchable and backup. So that's been watered down a bit.
Well, the reality, I think, is also that we're going to see some changes in usage behaviors as electric vehicles come online, mm-hmm. and people will probably be charging them overnight, perhaps when rates are traditionally lower. People might even want to be interested in net metering. We talked about that last week with Tony Clark and with John Bagieu, who's a solar power advocate in Fargo. And that also gets back to the grid and the sustainables and the renewables and the arguments that are, you know, pretty passionate because North Dakota is a fossil fuel state. And the people who buy power from North Dakota are not necessarily interested in fossil fuels. They just want the electricity.
Exactly. And that's why the Coal Creek Station was slated for shutdown is because the owner didn't think that coal was as viable as it used to be. So I know there's a real search to find a buyer for that plant. And there's a real search to, you know, have clean coal technologies, carbon capture, that type of thing, to keep coal viable. And I just happened to hear this on NPR this morning that there is still research going on at the Federal Department of Energy concerning capture carbon,
yes.
You know, carbon capture, to make sure that these are cleaner fuels, that they're not as polluting fuels, that they can remain a part of the mix.
And I think that's a concern, too. We talked, Tony Clark and I talked about that last week. He's a former chair of the North Dakota PSC. He was a commissioner with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And we were talking about carbon capture and the concern being that the technology is not quite there. The proof has not quite been made.
Correct.
But these coal-fired plants are just about to go offline. So can one thing happen in time?
That's the good – and that's why there's so much – you know, Project Tundra is one of the big things in North Dakota. They're hoping that works because that could be the demonstration for the rest of the country.
Meanwhile, places like Mercer County in North Dakota, coal country, are really looking at their future with serious concern.
Mm-hmm.
Amy, is this something that the Bismarck Tribune editorializes about? Or
Yeah, absolutely. We're definitely supportive of this type of research. And I think it's important to not only be researching whether it's technically feasible, but it needs to be commercially feasible. And that's one of the challenges that I think these companies are seeing.
Yeah, it is, because what we're hearing is that there are payments that might be made for successfully sequestering or using CO2 so it doesn't get into the atmosphere. And that gets us into subsidies and things like that. And that, of course, inflames the arguments even more. So,
you know, one thing that came up that I think is worth pursuing, there was some discussion about, you know, having big greenhouses, using the carbon dioxide for greenhouses. Plants love carbon dioxide. I think that's one to watch in the future to see if they come up with a plan to have a bunch of greenhouses that can use this captured CO2.
And I believe there is actually a CO2 line that's running into Canada now that
right.
is being used in their tar sands fields.
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Well, let's move on to another issue here, and that is infrastructure and bonding. The state isn't in the most robust budget circumstance, but there are investments that need to be made. Dave, set the foundation for us, then we'll expand on that.
There's a lot of support now for bonding among a certain section of the legislature, because right now, and this sounds almost oxymoronish, but money is cheap.
Yeah.
You can sell bonds, and the bond repayments are like 1.5%, and you can use this money to pay for roads, bridges, or buildings if you need to. But we've got a couple of sources to pay back the bonds. Number one, we mentioned the legacy fund, the legacy fund earnings. Some of that will go into that sinking interest fund. And if that's not enough, the Bank of North Dakota profits can help this out. So there are several ways that they can pay off these things. There is still a group in the legislature that does not like bonding all, because in a way that is deficit financing. But one thing that the current bill that has been approved by the House would do is to take care of some water projects. And the biggest one is to basically pay off the FM diversion, get that all paid for and get that started, and put some money toward the Mouse River Flood Control Project in Minot.
Well, Jacob, those of us in Flatland, North Dakota, are very appreciative of anything that protects us from flooding. The Red River Diversion is designed to do that. Is there any positioning in the Bismarck area among your viewers about, why is Fargo getting this big chunk of money?
Well, a lot of the discussion certainly has been watching the desire for legacy fund dollars and other infrastructure projects ultimately get whittled down mostly to these Fargo projects. And I think a lot of this has to do with just the growing demand for all of this infrastructure construction being done leading up to the pandemic. When the COVID kicked in, there were lawmakers that were traveling the state, having meeting with just having these open floor forums with citizens talking about what they want to see done with all this legacy money, done with any kind of bonding projects, especially out west where the demand has been greatest. And to watch these projects, watching these over $1 billion bills ultimately get whittled down to under $700 million, mostly water projects, it's been rather discouraging out here in central North Dakota. And I think a lot of it has to do with just lawmakers trying to meet the demand to keep up all of that hype for legacy use, and also trying to get those projects done that they consider to be the most necessary. Yeah. So much like everything else, legacy fund got political, and now everyone's just trying to get a slice of the pie and make amends. And apparently the answer is water projects in the East.
Dave, you mentioned that bonding is appealing to a lot of people simply because the interest rates are where they are. It's cheap money. And I would hope that legislators are watching the markets because the interest rates are starting to tick up, so time might be of the essence.
Absolutely. They want to get this done, and they want to get this bill signed and in the governor's hands so we could sign it and they can start issuing the bonds so they can get, you know, bonds at a decent rate. But, yeah, watch the interest rates because they are starting to tick up a little bit. And I want to follow up on Jacob's point there, too. One of the arguments that you hear is, why are you paying off the Red River Diversion now? Well, you pay it off, you get it off the books. And there's some money that was taken out of the Water Resources Trust Fund and the SIF Fund to help pay for that. If you do it by bonding, you get it off the books, and maybe you free up money for some other uses.
Okay. Let's move on to another issue that is pretty hot this year because we just had a census. And that means that legislative or governmental districts are redistricted for voters out there. And there are voting laws. Amy, let's talk about what's happening with redistricting and the flurry of voting laws that inevitably come up in any legislative session.
Yeah, I think what will be really interesting to watch with the redistricting is how it affects the rural areas. We have some districts, such as the one that covers Mandan and others in western North Dakota, that they cover such a large area, it's hard to see how they could get even bigger if that's what the census numbers indicate. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that all plays out and what considerations there'll be for the rural areas.
And voting laws, every legislative session, there seems to be some initiative out there to occasionally create a barrier or some other obstacle or requirement for people to vote. And apparently, after the presidential election, North Dakota is not unique in that area, Jacob, that many states in the U.S. are – the legislatures are looking at ways to change the voting practices that – we just experienced, which were highly controversial, highly partisan, and now seem to be reflected at the legislative level.
Yeah, lawmakers refer to Election Day as one of the most sacred days of the year. And as a political journalist, I'm not going to argue that in the slightest. But it seems as though what they saw last cycle and how the election was conducted isn't something that a slight majority of lawmakers don't want to see anymore. And we're seeing bills coming through that pull back how long early voting can happen. I want to say there's a bill that passed that brings early voting from 15 days before Election Day down to like 8 or 9 days. And there's another bill going through that would require the full ballot measure be printed on a ballot. And that's more of a response to Measure 3, which involved the Ethics Commission, which involved absentee voting. It involved a lot of different measures, but lawmakers said that they didn't like the short names that go on ballots because they think that's unrepresentative of what the measures actually show. So while that bill is going through, that would require ballots to ultimately be 3 or 4 pages in length if it does pass. At the same time, they passed another bill that would only allow 30 minutes for a voter to be in the booth to fill it out. Huh. So they're extending the length of the ballot while shortening how much time you have to vote and putting a clock on voters. So it's an interesting balance, and we're going to see how the Senate feels about it when it hits their floor.
Well, it gets us right down to the bottom line, which is, is voting a right or a privilege? And if you, you know, put a lot of requirements on it, it's starting to push toward privilege.
One of the bills that actually did get defeated was a bill that would require 1-year residency to vote. And I thought that was extremely interesting because the Supreme Court ruled in the early 70s, 30 days is plenty for your residency requirements. The sponsor said that some people would be moving just into his district just for a short time. They'd stay there 30 days, then they could vote, and then they'd leave again, but they established residency there. I kind of thought that argument was a little out there, but it didn't.
I also find that kind of fascinating to watch because there's a lot of people out west that live in North Dakota temporarily because of just the industry that they work in. So How is that going to affect voter turnout out in Dickinson and Williston?
That might be an unintended consequence.
Exactly.
Okay. Let's quickly touch on the story here that I saw in the forum today. In a rare move, the North Dakota State Board of Higher Education has endorsed the state Senate's higher education budget mid-session. This usually goes right to the end of the line, doesn't it, Dave?
Normally it does, but the Senate came up with what the Board of Higher Education considered to be very close to what they had proposed in their needs-based budget, and they thought that could be a very good, bill if it passes, but they're still going to be working on the House side to see if they can get some more money into it.
Okay. It's close to $650 million the base budget, so that's a fair amount of money. Let's move on to an issue that the state has been getting into very controversially, and for that matter, the U.S. Senate earlier this week did as well. And that has to do with transgender issues and specifically a bill in the legislature, Dave, that would limit the access or activity of transgender athletes.
Right. It basically requires if you're going to play sports at the high school level, you have to play with the gender identity you were born with. So transgenders would not be, if they were born, say, boys and on their way to become girls, they could not play on girls' teams. Some of the supporters were using the argument that actually follows more closely with this Title IX of the Higher Education Code. And the opponents say, no, it doesn't at all. And why are you discriminating against them? So it did pass. It passed the House, and I expect a very robust debate when that gets to the Senate.
Well, it seems to be, again, one of those issues that really is seeking a solution for which there is no problem right now. There haven't been any cases of this at all, have there, Amy?
Yeah, it was interesting that the High School Activities Association really did not testify on the bill. There were no coaches that testified on the bill. They may have privately reached out to lawmakers, but we didn't see any real public comment of any schools asking for this legislation. So it's kind of puzzling as to why it had so much support.
Well, the forum today had an editorial saying that it would cause more harm than good. On Monday, I'll be talking to Charlie Johnson. He's the president of the Fargo-Moorhead Convention and Visitors Bureau. They've taken a position against this bill, and I think it's because one reason is the optics outside our borders would be awful.
I think a lot of the interest behind this particular bill is lawmakers in the state trying to make an argument that other states haven't made. You mentioned the optics outside of North Dakota. We've seen bills similar to this pass in other states, and they lose major, major projects. The NCAA tends to pull out when they see bills like this. And North Dakota is set to host a March Madness game or two in the coming years. And now lawmakers in North Dakota are trying to make a new argument that this isn't necessarily about protecting families, which is what other states argue. You brought up that this is about Title IX to them. And when this bill passed, I think a lot of people were genuinely surprised because we've seen a lot of social issue bills pass through the state house or at least be introduced in the state house and get shot down almost immediately. So to see this bill, which has been getting the most public backlash, passing with, well, it wasn't a very slim margin. I think that came as a shock to people, and now the Senate's going to have eyes on them harder on this than I think they wanted to in the House.
Okay. Well, let's close with another issue that's been much discussed over the years, Dave, but now may be moving, and that is the vote in the House for adult recreational marijuana and a plan to tax it.
You know, I was a little surprised that it passed, because they tried this before and it hasn't passed. And now the people with Legalize ND, the group that wanted to put it on the ballot, saying if it passes the Senate, everything's off the table, we're going to go with this. It's restrictive. You can only buy marijuana at these compassion centers. You can only grow marijuana at the manufacturing centers, unlike the measure that was going to be on the ballot, which basically says you could grow your own. So it is very restricted, but it is a step that a lot of us were surprised to see the House take.
Amy, were you surprised at the Bismarck Tribune?
I was, and it's interesting, you know, that it was sponsored by Representative Jason Doctor from here in Bismarck, who is very open about the fact that he personally does not support recreational marijuana, but he saw it coming in all of our neighboring states and saw this ballot measure coming and felt like it was the legislature's job to be proactive and have more ability to fine-tune the bill and add those restrictions in there.
Jacob, I think sometimes the devil's in the details, though. Dave mentioned the compassion centers. There aren't that many of them, and there are only two grow centers. And when you add recreational to the, you know, the consumer list, aside from medical, one would think that those are going to have to be much bigger grow centers.
No kidding. No, it might just be because I'm recently out of college that I wasn't entirely surprised to see this thing pop out. But as we mentioned, it's becoming more of a when it becomes legal than an if it becomes legal situation. We've been seeing the popularity for it grow in the state, pardon the pun on grow. But I think what we're going to have to keep our eye on is with the restrictions that are in place as far as who can grow it and who can sell it, North Dakota has already seen demand and supply issues in the recent year. The medicinal centers have reported shortages. They've reported running out of their product. And that was when the program had already been in place for some time. This was just a supply chain issue. So if we're going to be passing this thing and it becomes law around 2022, 2023, there's going to have to be, and it always leads to infrastructure, there's going to have to be some form of loosening up the laws if we're going to meet the demand that this will inevitably bring.
Jacob Noderman is a reporter with KFYRT in Bismarck. Thanks, Jacob, for being with us today for our Journalist Roundtable.
Hey, thank you.
Amy Dalrymple Moulter is the editor of the Bismarck Tribune. Always a pleasure to have you with us, Amy.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And our own Prairie Public News Director, Dave Thompson, is a Roundtable regular. Have a great weekend, Dave.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. A Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 26th. Earlier this month, we heard how another wave of influenza struck North Dakota in early 1920. More than 130 Bismarck residents fell ill in just 3 weeks. At the time, Bismarck's population was about 7,000. In February of 1920, for the first time since the pandemic emerged in 1918, the capital city logged more deaths than births in a calendar month. One of the most tragic flu deaths in 1920 was a Washburn farmer who months earlier had been crushed between two tractors. He survived and recovered from extensive rib injuries, only to catch the flu and die just weeks after leaving the hospital. 15 people died in Grand Forks from the flu early in the year, but on this date in 1920, the University of North Dakota resumed activities at the University Community House, which included Sunday school and night classes managed by university students. Elsewhere in North Dakota, a shortage of nurses in Munich led young men to offer their services to nurse whole families sick with the flu. A doctor in Columbus was caring for 160 flu patients, and many schools were closed due to the epidemic, like those in Bowman, Lignite, and Monango. Later in 1920, the Secretary of North Dakota State Board of Health filed a 2-year report that summarized the pandemic. He wrote, "During this period, we have been visited by the worst epidemic, perhaps, the world has ever known." It's unknown how many North Dakotans died from the flu pandemic. One estimate is 5,100 people. It hit the state when North Dakota had poor public health administration. There was no full-time state health officer. Instead, there was a 3-member board of health led by the Attorney General. Many cities and counties had health officers, but most had little or no money for health work. The state also had fewer physicians and nurses to respond to the pandemic. In the fall of 1918, as many were overseas in World War I, Red Cross volunteers stepped in to help. And weeks before the 1922 flu wave, the legislature cut the entire budget of the State Board of Health. The governor used an emergency fund to bolster the board's budget. After years of advocates pushing for it, the 1923 legislature established North Dakota's Department of Health, including a full-time state health officer and an advisory council. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jack Dura. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Raining cats and dogs does not come from sodden, thatched roofs that had animals on them and that would fall through when it rained a lot.
Thank you. Please do not send us that email.
Does not come from that. Has never come from that.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
For the life of me, we never understood the joke, and I was hoping that you could explain it to us.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. And as you know, when we broadcast, we stream online. And after the broadcast or stream, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Monday on Main Street, Steve Wingate will discuss his new novel, The Leave Takers, for the Flyover Fiction Series, which is published by the University of Nebraska. This series highlights authors who write about the Great Plains. And Charlie Johnson, president of the Fargo-Moorhead Visitors and Convention Bureau, will join us to talk about his organization's concerns about a bill that targets transgender students in athletics. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday. We hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.